And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Okay, folks, let's deal with the elephant in the room right from the start. I work for Jeff Zucker at CNN, but that's not why I invited him on The Axe Files, which I think you'll agree when you hear this conversation may not have been the shrewdest career move of my life. I invited him because his life story is a hell of a yarn and his impact on broadcast journalism has been undeniable. We sat down and talked about all of this last week at CNN headquarters in New York. And yes, Zucker's long, intriguing relationship with Donald Trump did come up. Here's that conversation. Jeff Zucker, it's good to be with you.
Happy to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Homestead, Florida, where the whole saga begins. And I'm guessing that the Zuckers didn't come over on the Mayflower.
No, they did not. Actually, it wasn't just Homestead, Florida. I was born on Homestead Air Force Base, which was, of course, later demolished by Hurricane Andrew. So I was an Air Force kid. My dad was a cardiologist in the Air Force. He came down from New York. Met my mom, who grew up her whole life in Miami, which was very rare for somebody in that era. They met on a blind date down in Miami and ended up staying there. My dad got assigned to Homestead Air Force Base, and that's where I was born, and that's where it all started.
And where did the Zuckers come from originally?
So the Zuckers originally came from somewhere in Eastern Europe that is probably Poland now. You know, somewhere on the Poland-Russia border that has probably changed five times.
And when did they come over?
So they came in the late 1800s, you know, before the turn of the century.
And you were always a pugnacious little dude.
Thank you.
You were a high school tennis player. Your coach said you wouldn't settle for being the number two singles guy. You had to be the number one singles guy.
Well, I didn't deserve to be the number two singles player. I was worthy of being the number one player.
And you got there by?
Listen, I played tennis my whole life. So this is really was the most important thing in my life was I started playing tennis when I was 6 years old. And I played tennis every day. And I was pretty good when I was young. You know, I was pretty highly ranked in Florida as a young kid. What happened was, by the time we got to the 14s and 16 and unders, I didn't grow the way that everybody else grew. And so all these kids who I was beating when we were in the 10 and unders and 12 and unders and beginning of 14 and unders,
they did grow.
All of a sudden start beating me, and I'm going, what is going on here? And it's because they had grown and they could serve and volley. But having said that, I still was pretty good, and I played number one on my high school tennis team, 10th, 11th, and 12th grades.
But it did allow you to run for class president every year.
It's also
under
true.
Under the slogan, the little man with the big ideas.
Well, as I mentioned, I didn't grow, and so so I was still the little man.
I'm just trying to get at, because one of the memes that runs through your entire life is you are a competitive person.
Yes, and I'm a trying competitive to get, little guy. Yes, that's true.
The little guy we can leave aside for now.
Well.
But where does that come from?
Yeah, so it is true. It is totally fair. I have been competitive my whole life. I played competitive tennis. I ran for, you know, student government office every year. I always wanted to win. And where did that come from? You know, I mean, listen, I've lied down on the couch before and tried to analyze that and figure it out. You know, it's not like my parents put pressure on me or anything like that. It was just, I think that was the DNA I was born with. We played touch football, you know, on my block growing up. I wanted to win, okay? We played a tennis match. I wanted to win. I ran for student government president. I wanted to win. So, you know, has stayed with me my whole life, I acknowledge.
Yeah, it served you pretty well.
Yeah, listen, you know, I think the important thing actually has been about learning to lose with grace. Because when I was young playing tennis, I had a pretty bad temper on the court. And it was not very becoming. And I have plenty of broken tennis rackets to prove it. And And so it's one of the things that I think as you mature, you learn, you know, it's great to win, but you also have to learn how to lose. And I think that took some time in my life, but listen, I'm as competitive today as I was when I was 6 years old playing tennis.
I want to talk a little bit later about losing, because you've had like meteoric success, and when you are up on that high wire and you fail, then that's the whole world sees it
and they love it.
And that's yeah. Well, I'm sure that's right. But I want to talk to you about that in a second.
Sure.
But this whole competitiveness thing struck me. Your first column, your first All That Jazz column for the Harvard Crimson,
right,
was about house football at Harvard, and you started.
It was.
Yeah, it was called "Frustrated Jocks and First Timers Find House Football More Than Just Fun."
You are a very good researcher. There's no way I would ever remember that.
We probably have it for you if you want it, but you start off by saying everyone's little league coach preached that it's not whether you win or lose, but how you play the game that's important. And then you went on to say
wasn't
exactly the spirit of the house football league. And it struck me that you probably weren't one who bought into that it's how you play the game.
It's much better to win.
Yeah.
Oh, no, totally. I mean, listen, I think the thing you learn over time is that it is also important how you play the game. But it's still better to win. It's still better to win.
One other place you won was you got elected president of the Crimson.
I did. So, yeah, listen, I went to Harvard after high school in Miami. I went up to Harvard, and I played freshman tennis, so I was still interested in tennis. But I realized I wasn't going to be able to play real college tennis, so I let that go. And I threw myself into the college newspaper, the Harvard Crimson, and I covered sports my freshman year, which was a not a common route to get to leadership at the Crimson. Most people went through the news area. I started in sports, but I worked my way up, and I became the president of the Crimson. And, you know, as some people have said, it's been downhill ever since. That was the highlight of my life. But, you know, I've had other good highlights. But being the president of Crimson was pretty exciting.
So speaking of competitiveness, you were pissed when Conan O'Brien stole your newspapers. He was the editor of the Harvard Lampoon.
Right.
Thought it'd be fun to steal a whole press run of the Harvard Crimson. And what'd you do about that?
So, look, you know, there was always a rivalry between the Crimson and the Lampoon. And, you know, the Lampoon was picking on us at this time, and they stole all our newspapers. and we caught them. And I called the Cambridge police, and I asked.
The campus police. The campus police were too genteel
for
you.
No, I did not call the Harvard police. I called the Cambridge police, and I told them that I wanted to press charges.
Well, was the FBI not available? Or?
Well, you know, I mean, that was the next step. That was the next step. If they didn't come quickly enough, but I called the Cambridge police, told them I wanted to press charges. You know, listen. They want to play games with us. It's a competitive thing, right? We're gonna play right back. And so I asked them to arrest Conan O'Brien, and they did. They took him down to, you know, central booking. And I remember I got a call from the dean of students at the time at Harvard, Archie Epps, who has since passed away. And he said to me, "Jeff, you don't really want to press charges against Conan O'Brien." And I responded, "No, I do. I actually do." Now, of course, and I'm sure we'll probably get to it, Conan O'Brien comes back in my life
yes,
at a later point.
Exactly.
But it's a very rich story, yes.
And so you were rejected by Harvard Law School. That was
I was.
You did well. Now, was that your first big setback in life?
I think it was. You know, look, I led a very charmed life. I had been president of my sophomore class, junior class, senior class in high school, played number one on the tennis
team. You have siblings, by the way?
I have a younger sister.
And was she also a super achiever?
She did well, and she was a really good athlete. But I do think that I cast a long shadow in high school, and that was a little tough for her, in all candor. But so I go to Harvard, and I do incredibly well. I become the president of the Harvard Crimson. You know, like anybody who isn't sure what they want to do with their life at that point, you apply to law school. And so I applied to several law schools, and I applied to Harvard Law School. And I thought, you know, listen, I'm at Harvard, I've done well, and I'm president of the Crimson, I'm going to get in. And I didn't get in. And I was stunned. And I remember crying on my bed at Harvard senior year. I couldn't believe it. It was the first time that I really didn't get something I wanted. And I couldn't believe it. And as I say now, I thank God every day I didn't get into Harvard.
Yeah, it was probably the biggest break you ever got.
Thank God. I say it all the time. And you know, if I'd gotten in, I probably would have gone. And so I thank God all the time. I also say that I'd like to apply now and see what happens and see if I could get in. But no, listen, thank God I didn't get in. I took a two-year deferral. I did get into several other law schools. I took a two-year deferral from the University of Virginia. And the reason I did that from the University of Virginia Law School was because they were the only ones who offered a two-year deferral. And needless to say, I never went.
So. Because you got a chance to work for NBC as a researcher for the 1988 Olympics.
Right. So the day that I graduated from college, I got the call from NBC Sports offering me the job as the Olympic researcher, which was really at the time in 1986, you know, one of probably the best entry-level job in television. What I did was I was able to travel the world at NBC's expense, doing all the background reporting on all the athletes and sports for the Seoul Olympics. And you know, it was 2.5 years, an incredible experience. And then at the Olympics, you know, I worked with this guy who was the brand new first-time announcer at the Olympics, a host of the Olympics, a guy was new to it named Bob Costas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that turned out to be a lifelong friendship that was just fortuitous for both of us. And so it was great. And by the way, what's interesting is, again, the way in for me, like it had been at the Crimson where I did sports and then moved and became the president, I started my career in sports and eventually moved to news.
Let me ask you a question about that. This was really a reporting job in some ways.
It was.
And you've used reporting as a way into editing. I was a reporter when I started, and there was a definite division among the staff, among people who just want to be reporters, never wanted to be editors, and people who were on that track. You tend to the editorial, and why? Why did you prefer that? Because you were in charge, or because you could run the big picture?
Well, you know, look, I think I liked both aspects of it, right? You know, I always loved writing, and I think I'm a pretty good writer. And I liked writing. I liked reporting.
Your mom was an English teacher.
My mom was an English teacher and debate coach, by the way.
Must have been an interesting dinner table.
At my rival high school, by the way. So I always liked the writing and reporting. But, you know, I did always tend to want to then run the organization or be in charge of the Crimson or, you know.
NBC.
NBC, wherever it ended up. And, you know, listen, I always have felt that being in charge of those organizations but having grown up in them gave me the perspective so that I understood what everybody's job was and that I thought I was a better leader because I knew what their jobs were.
You know, I did a podcast with Theo Epstein.
Yeah.
And Theo, you may know, was the editor. He was a sports editor of the Yale Daily News.
Right.
And he took a job as an intern with the Baltimore Orioles, and he was basically clipping things. And he said, I figured out that there's 20% of every job no one wants to do. And if you volunteer to do that 20%, you'll learn about a lot of different aspects of things, and you'll make a lot of friends along the way.
Well, I totally agree with that, and I feel that's what I did when I first went to the Today Show after the Olympics job. I ended up at the Today Show, and I was low man on the totem pole, and I did everything. And I did everything that nobody else wanted to do. And I pulled all-nighters all the time. And this was in an era when the Berlin Wall was falling and the tanks were rolling into Moscow and Noriega was captured. And so I was the one there overnight, the only one there doing all the work. And, you know, that put me in good position, got me noticed, and left me with a true understanding of all the jobs that needed to be done.
At the Olympics, Jane Pauley called you a walking fact machine.
Yeah. So what happened was I was the Olympic researcher, and I was assigned to work on two shows, the late night show with Bob Costas, this first-time host, and the morning show with, among other people, Jane Pauley. And Jane had come, obviously, from the Today Show and was asked to do the Olympics, and she was scared to death because she knew nothing about sports, nothing about the Olympics. And I was there with her the whole time. And you know,
she was a big proponent of you coming over to the Today Show.
Helped her through the whole Olympics. At the end of the Olympics, she says, "What are you going to do now?" And I said, "I have no idea," because my 2-year deferment from the University of Virginia Law School had already passed, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And she goes, "Well, I'd like you to come work on the Today Show with me." And I said, "Okay." And you know, I had never seen the Today Show at this time. Right when you're in high school, you basically are gone before the Today Show comes up. In college, you sleep through the Today Show. And in this job at the Olympics, I had been traveling the world and not paying attention to the Today Show. But it was a job, and it was Jane Pauley.
Well, let me, about television itself, you didn't know bupkis about TV other than probably having watched it.
Right.
But, and were you, was what attracted to you, yeah, you to TV, and had you thought of yourself as a print guy before?
Yeah,
then?
I had always thought of myself as a writer and a print guy. I worked for the Miami Herald when I was in high school.
Doing high school sports, or what were you doing?
I was doing like local neighborhood reporting. So I'd worked for the Miami Herald and had written for my high school newspaper, written for my college newspaper. So again, if I didn't get into law school and I didn't get the job at NBC, I wanted to go home and write for the Miami Herald. Mm-hmm. So I had always thought of myself in that vein as a print reporter. My first experience with television was I worked as an intern at the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles for ABC Sports. And that's how I eventually ended up at NBC,
right,
in 88. But I didn't really know much about television or how it worked. But I do remember in 84 at the Olympics in LA of sneaking a look into the control room and watching Rune Arledge at work. And I thought, okay, that's pretty cool. And so I was attracted to television, even though I had always thought of myself as a print guy. And then, honestly,
you thought it was cool because he was calling the shots.
He was calling the shots, and it was like an orchestra. A control room that works in a live television aspect is like an orchestra. And the executive producer is the conductor. And you're calling out the shots, and you're talking to the anchors, and it's an incredible thing to see. And eventually, that's what I ended up doing, and I loved it. And there's nowhere I love being more than in a control room for a big live event.
You still do that. You still,
I do.
You still,
I do.
You're
I do,
still calling
people,
the shots.
I do, and people, a lot of people don't understand why, you know, someone who's running CNN would want to also go into the control room on the big election nights or big event nights, and sit in the seat. And the reason is because I think there's nothing more exciting in television than live television on a big night. And you know, I think for many years it's what I did, and I loved it. I think that I am very good under pressure in a control room, and I think I understand story pretty well. And so I think that you have to figure out what the story is at a moment's notice. And I think all of those things are why I love being in a control room.
So when you were a kid, you were a field producer for Katie Couric.
I was.
And
at the Today Show, yeah.
And so you were what, 23, 24?
Yeah. I mean, I was, 23, 24 years old when I was producing for Katie.
And then not so long after that, you became the supervising producer for the Today Show. So now you're in the... You're in the room.
And now I'm in the control room. And so by the age of, 24, 25, I'm basically running the control room at the Today Show, which is absurd if you think about it. But it's not like anybody ever taught me how to, run a control room. I just, figured it out.
Yeah.
And...
I appreciate that. I've never been trained for anything I've ever done.
Right. It's like, look, I think a lot of it is intuitive, and you just learn how it works, and you figure it out. And I think I did have a real, I think I had a real sense of how to conduct that orchestra. and it turned out to be good, and I got really noticed at that young age.
And by the time you're 25, you're the executive producer of the Today Show.
Yeah, so I think I turned 26 when I
slacker
take over exactly. Yeah. Look, you know, I was incredibly lucky and fortunate. I had worked incredibly hard. The Today Show was not doing very well at the time.
Yes.
And so they decided, well, let's just take a chance on this young guy. Now, I was very fortunate that the president of NBC News was a gentleman named Michael Gartner.
Former print guy.
Pulitzer Prize winner. In fact, was the page one editor of the Wall Street Journal when he was 26. Mm-hmm. And so he had no compunction about asking a 26-year-old punk to take over the Today Show. And he said something that always stayed with me, which was that, you know, he thought good things happen to young people because they're good. And it doesn't matter how old they are. And if you're good, you're good. And he had the, you know, good fortune of having run the Wall Street Journal page one at a very young age. And so he didn't hold my age against me the way others did.
Yeah.
And he gave me that opportunity.
We should note that he ultimately went out to Des Moines.
Correct.
And became the owner after working at the Register, publisher of the Register, owner of the Iowa Cubs.
Correct. Exactly.
So what could be better than
exactly.
that?
Exactly. No, and it's actually quite a charmed life. You know, he's the page one editor of the Wall Street Journal, runs NBC News, wins a Pulitzer, and then, you know, runs the Des Moines Register and then moves into baseball. So great life.
So you remade morning TV.
Yeah. So what happened was the Today Show was just not doing very well. And I was put into this position of trying to turn it around. And I think that what I did is I was not afraid to try new things and to change things up. And what I said to everybody was that I understood the tradition of the Today Show.
Which went way back.
It was one of the oldest shows in the history of television, began in 1952. And so I told everybody, look, I understand the tradition.
I think there was a monkey in the cast
there
at that
was,
time.
There was, J. Fred Muggs.
Yes.
Actually, J. Fred Muggs wasn't there when the Today Show went on the air. J. Fred Muggs came in a few months after the start because the ratings weren't doing well, and they needed to bring in the monkey to try to up the ratings. So,
but you didn't reconsider bringing him back.
Well, we were thinking about something like that. But anyway, actually, I'll tell you a funny story about that. We digress. Is when I was running the Today Show, I had us do a piece on whatever happened to J. Fred Muggs, and it turned out we found him, we think, at an animal park in somewhere in Florida.
But anyway, are there DNA tests?
Yeah, I digress. But anyway, look, I always said that I understood the tradition of the Today Show, but I wasn't bound by it. And so what that meant was that, you know, look, I'm not going to do anything to embarrass the Today Show, but I'm not going to keep doing the same things we've been doing. You know, people would come up to me and they would say, well, we don't do it that way. And I would say, well, the way we've been doing it isn't working. And so, you know, that gave us the ability to just throw out the playbook and try a lot of new things. And so what we did is we introduced a really hard news first half hour.
No ads for 22 minutes.
No ads for 22
Which
minutes.
Which is a tradition now.
Now everybody does it. But before that, it was, you know, heresy to even think about that. So we instituted a really hard news half hour, and then we came up with a lot of gimmicks, including, you know, where in the world is Matt Lauer, and we Today Throws a Wedding, and outdoor concerts at the Today Show. And so we built this whole thing. Now, there were two events that also really helped us change the dynamic of the Today Show. The O.J. Simpson trial in 1995, I think we recognized early on that this was going to be a real cultural touch point. And we covered it intensely and did, you know, went all in on coverage of this, which is a theme that I would later reprise at CNN when we would go all in on a big story. But the first time we ever did this was on the O.J. Simpson trial. And Charlie Gibson was the anchor of GMA, and he took shots at us in the newspapers by saying, I can't believe how much coverage of O.J. Simpson they're doing. And my response was, well, it's interesting, it's good, and the audience wants it. And then the other, and then the next thing that happened was the 96 election. I'm sorry. When I was supervising producer, it was the 92 election. The first one was the 92 election when I took over. I'm sorry, not 96, mm-hmm. 92 election.
Yeah.
And that was an incredibly exciting election because there were three candidates, right?
Ross Perot was the independent. And Bush, yeah.
Right. And we actually had a tremendous in with Ross Perot. And so we recognized his popularity very early on, and we had Ross Perot on all the time before anybody else did. And the other thing is then we would start having Bill Clinton on for these hour-long interviews when the history of interviews with candidates was you'd have him on for 5 minutes, okay? Mm-hmm. We had him on for an hour. And then
he was uniquely qualified to do an hour.
He was, okay, but we took advantage of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we'd have Bill Clinton on for 2 hours. So the entire Today Show was 2 hours. We'd have Ross Perot on for an hour mm-hmm. or 2 hours. And so it was like nobody could believe that this is what the Today Show was doing, but they were talking about us. We were getting notices. We were relevant in a way we hadn't been. And so that is how we changed up the Today Show.
The other thing you did was you changed up the cast of the Today Show. And I wanted to ask you about that. When you're framing a show like that, particularly a morning show, how important is the casting and how they relate to each other and how people relate to them?
Yeah. Well, you know, we always thought that was the most important thing in the show. It wasn't the stories we did or the two-hour interviews with the political candidate. The shows lived and died on the chemistry with the hosts. You know, people are watching morning shows in their boxers and pajamas with toothpaste drooling out of their mouth.
Attractive picture.
Exactly, eating soggy cornflakes. That's just the reality mm-hmm. of the time of day that the show is on. And the way they watch the program. So it's a very intimate experience, much more so than any other kind of news program. So they have to want to spend time with these people, and the only way you want to spend time with them is if they want to spend time with each other. So they had to get along. And so, you know, obviously we had several cast changes through the years on the Today Show. The first major one that we did was we brought in Katie Couric. Again, remember the show wasn't doing well,
right.
I mentioned, and so Katie and Bryant had a pretty magnetic spark that worked incredibly well, and that was part of the turnaround. Then eventually Bryant decided to move on himself. I think it was in January of 97, and we brought in Matt Lauer,
mm-hmm.
and the relationship between Matt Lauer and Katie Couric was also quite dynamic.
I have to ask you about this. You mentioned Where in the World is Matt Lauer, and I know you guys were friends and probably still are friends, but it turns out that Where in the World, sometimes he was where he wasn't supposed to be, doing things he wasn't supposed to be doing. And I know you've said that you didn't know about any of that, but I think people are incredulous
right.
about that because you're such a involved
right.
leader.
So you have to remember a couple of things. First of all, I've been gone from any daily interaction with Matt for 18 years. Mm-hmm. I left the Today Show at the end of 2000.
Right.
So, you know, really what I think most people have talked about with regard to what happened with Matt, I think has, you know, pretty much been since I was not there. As I said, I left in 2000. If anything was going on prior to that, I was unaware of it. As I said, you know, he came as the anchor in 97. And, you know, in those 3 or 4 years that I was there, I saw absolutely no evidence of that, heard nothing of this sort. You know, he got married in somewhere in the middle of there, like in 98. And that was, you know, that was what you know, I thought he was focused on. So
you were at some event and there were some body kind of casting couch jokes at one point that intimated that.
Oh, the roast. There was a Friars Club roast.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a Friars Club roast. I don't know, sometime in the mid 2008, 2009 mm-hmm. era.
That was later.
I think there were a lot of people who made jokes about Matt. But you know, that was the nature of a roast, right? Mm-hmm. It was a Friars Club roast, and so I think you have to understand that everybody gets made fun of like that. But like I said, I never was aware or was.
Was that
made
a problem
aware.
In the industry generally?
You know, I think you can't paint it with a broad brush, and each of these incidents that we've become aware of, I think are different in and of themselves. Listen, obviously, you can't condone any of this behavior, and as I've said, if we had been aware of any of it, we would have dealt with it immediately.
It strikes me that what Donald Trump said in the Access Hollywood tape, vile as it was, reflected not just his own thinking, but it was a more broadly held kind of thing, which is that guys felt like, who were stars, as he said, felt like they could have their way.
Well, I think there's always been a, there's always been this thing about Hollywood and, mm-hmm. and casting couches and mm-hmm. and stars that has had that kind of sentiment as wrong as it is. I mean, I think that there is a long held sentiment that was okay. It clearly was not okay. You know, now I think what Donald Trump said on the Access Hollywood thing was even over the line for that kind of thinking. But look, if you look back at the advertising world that was portrayed in the Mad Men era, and you look back at old Hollywood, and you look back at television and media and movies, sure, has there always been a male-oriented belief that they were entitled? Unfortunately, yeah, that was the world that existed.
You think that it's changed now with all of this, with the Me Too stuff?
I do think that there has been a tremendous change. Look, I think there was a change over time. The Mad Men era, wasn't the same as it always was, but there was still bad behavior. I think the same thing was true in media. But I do think there's been a tremendous change, and there's much more recognition that bad behavior was going on and could not be tolerated.
You went through a couple of ordeals during the 90s, even as you were sort of the king of morning television and you started moving up the NBC ladder. 31 years old, you're diagnosed with colon cancer.
Yeah. So, I was 31 and out of the blue, no family history, nothing, just a complete freak. I was diagnosed with colon cancer.
Ironically, you had done a lot on the show because Katie's husband was battling that. Wasn't that about the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually came a little later.
Mm-hmm.
But it was ironic that Katie, who was we were so close and had grown up together like that on the show, then had to endure the same kind of illness, and tragically her husband found his colon cancer too late and he did not survive. If anything, I was incredibly fortunate that my colon cancer at the age of 31, we got it. I did have to then go through 9 months of chemotherapy because it had spread. But
it came back, right?
But I was, fortunate. And then what happened was when I was 34 in 1999, on a routine checkup, discovered for the second time that I had colon cancer. And it was not a recurrence. It was a second. It was a whole second episode. And so clearly now I'm 34. I've had colon cancer twice. It's clear that I have this propensity to grow tumors in my colon. So what we did is, because they were going to keep coming back, it was clear. So the surgeons decided to remove as much of my colon as they could without giving me a colostomy bag. And so they took out 90% of my colon. And Let me ask you something. Thankfully, I have had nothing since.
You were, as you mentioned, 31, 34, had small children.
Yeah.
What were you thinking at the time? How frightening was it?
Yeah, listen, I still to this day remember the phone call I got from the doctor to tell me I had cancer. I couldn't believe it. It was an incredibly frightening experience. I remember the day the doctor came to my hospital bed and told me that it had spread and I was going to have to undergo chemotherapy. And I cried, you know, again. You know, it was an incredibly harrowing experience and very, very difficult.
But I read that you arranged to have your chemo on Fridays so that you could not miss any work because the quote I saw was, I didn't want anybody to think I couldn't do the job.
Yeah, so it is true. The first time that I had cancer and I had to undergo the chemotherapy, I scheduled it Friday late afternoon, went to the hospital, was hooked up to an IV, took the drip, and then went home and slept till about Sunday afternoon, till it wore off, and then got up Monday morning and went and did the Today Show. And I did not want anybody to think I couldn't do the job, and I didn't...
Were you worried that someone would take the job?
No, it wasn't that I was worried that anybody was going to take the job. It was I didn't want anybody to think that this was going to get me down. I wasn't going to let this cancer get in the way. I wasn't going to let it beat me. And so I arranged for me to be able to take care of myself and to do my job. And, you know, I think that goes back to the competitive thing we were talking about early, is that, you know, I was not going to let this beat me. And, you know, and it was hard. It was hard. I got hospitalized one time during the chemotherapy because they gave me too much, which is what they try to do because they want to give you as much as you can. And, you know, I do remember in 96, my surgery was on Halloween. I remember watching the Halloween costume contest before on the Today Show before I went into surgery, and then I was in the hospital for election night of 96 that I was supposed to be producing for NBC, and I watched it from my hospital room, and you know, I remember that quite vividly.
And were you thinking, not that camera, this camera?
I think... I don't know that I was critiquing it, but I remember that I wasn't there.
Yeah,
and then eventually,
did you ever think I'm going to die?
I was worried about it, and yeah, you know, look, I feel like I feel like I've stared at the possibility of dying a couple times in my life, and you know, look, not to get ahead of ourselves, but I have had an incredible life, and I have led a charmed life, and I've had a lot of success. There have been some low points, but I've had a lot of success, and I've got four great kids and everything. But I have been tested with illnesses and
not just that, but Bell's palsy. Well, you've had heart surgery and so on.
So look, I mean, if you really want to list them, it's been really hard. I've had colon cancer twice, and I've had Bell's palsy. I've had open heart surgery. I've had 5 kidney stones. I've had gout. I've had 3 knee surgeries, and you know, and I'm probably leaving out some stuff.
How did all that change you?
Well, I mean, look, you know, I do understand what's important, even though I still remain competitive, and you know, sometimes I can be still hyper competitive. I do understand how lucky I am to be alive, and I do understand that. I think there's many times when I probably could have died. Through any of the colon cancers or any of the heart issues I've had. I know I'm lucky to be alive, and that has given me tremendous perspective. I don't take any of this for granted, and I've led a great life, but I am lucky, and I'm lucky to be alive.
You, in the 2000s, once you recovered that, you had this sort of, you made this transition, you moved up the ladder at NBC, you went out to LA and took over their entertainment division. That was not an unvarnished success for you, and you went out there. First of all, you weren't very well received.
Well, I was the, I don't think that Hollywood really understood why this news guy from New York was coming to run an entertainment division. And, you know, that's why Jack Welch at GE and Bob Wright at NBC wanted me to go there. They didn't want a creature of Hollywood. But it set up a relationship that, you know, was not perfect.
And there probably was an element of you being who you are.
Yeah.
Telling the Hollywood people that, just as you did the people at the Today Show, you know what, you guys aren't exactly doing it right. I got a better idea. I'm going to try it. That probably wasn't well received.
Yeah, look, I mean, listen, I probably...
I don't want to use the word impudent, but...
No, I mean, listen, I acknowledge I went out there. I've always acknowledged through my life that I've been a little cocky. I think I went out there with a little bit of an attitude that was probably unhelpful to the situation. And, you know, I think we did a lot of good things. I think I made a lot of mistakes. And I think the community at that time didn't quite know what to make of me and wasn't necessarily rooting for me.
I am going to leave aside the one of the big decisions you made, which was to start a show called The Apprentice, for a couple of minutes here, because it leads into a longer discussion about the star of the show. But you went through, you kept rising until you were the CEO of NBC. Some decisions that got a lot of attention. One was about late night TV, putting Jay Leno on at 10, moving Conan in there. Didn't work out.
Correct.
Didn't work out. And and Comcast bought NBC. You lost your, you gave up your job, but you...
No. I didn't give up my job. They asked me to leave.
All right, good. I was trying to be polite about it.
Why would you be polite? I was...
You signed my freaking paycheck.
No, it's okay. No. Listen. I mean, I don't think that they asked me to leave because the late night debacle happened, which it did. I don't ever deny that. I think they asked me to leave because they bought the company and they had their person who they wanted to run it. Absolutely. But to be clear, I was asked to leave.
You were 45 years old. You were a prodigy. Now you're 45 years old.
And you've done.
Yeah. So tell me about that. First of all, there were a lot of people cheering because nobody likes the prodigy. Nobody likes the upstart who does it better. Nobody likes being challenged. But there were... This is a competitive business. Yeah. I know. Listen, man, I'm from politics, so I understand this completely. People, you know, they don't necessarily celebrate your successes and they don't necessarily mourn your failures.
Right.
And you failed on a very big stage there, in the sense that you were asked to leave. How did you process that, the ultimately competitive guy?
Yeah. So, look, I mean, listen, it was a hard... It was a hard time for me. I had spent my entire career and life at NBC, right? I went there. Remember, I got the job the day I graduated, went to work there in August of 1986, and spent the next 25 years there. It was the only thing I knew. It was the only building I had ever walked into to work at, right, in New York. And it was the only company I'd ever worked for. It was my life, right? So that was hard. That was hard to, accept that was over.
What about the whole thing? But you had such stunning success at such an early age. What about something that turned out badly like this?
Well look, I don't really look at it that it turned out badly. I look at it that it was an incredible 25-year run, and at the end, the company was sold, and I was asked to leave. So I don't really look at it that it was an ignominious end. I look at it as, you know what, the company was sold, and I was asked to leave. But I was asked to leave. I'm not in denial mm-hmm. about that. You know, if I had been king of the hill, they probably wouldn't have asked me to leave.
And do you, I know you went to work with Katie on a show that she did.
We did a daytime show
at ABC.
For about a year, I went there. But no, listen,
didn't do well. Were you just trying to figure out?
I didn't know what my next move was going to be. Listen, mm-hmm. I was 45 years old, and I had pretty much, you know, because I had had a lot of success at a very young age, I had done a ton of things, right? And in the media business, there wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of mountains left to climb. You know, the one thing that I still wanted to do in life was, you know, go home and run the Miami Dolphins, which I tell everybody that's the one thing I would leave anything to go do. But that wasn't in the cards either. So I didn't know what I was going to do, and so it was a little bit of a strange time. For the first time in my life, when I woke up, I didn't know where I was going to go or what I was going to do, and that was hard. That was hard. You know, eventually, CNN comes knocking, and you know, CNN was looking for a new leader, and I was interested in it. And the reason I was interested, even though a lot of people thought, well, why would he go to CNN? It's so much smaller. He ran a huge media company. Why would he just want to go run one channel? And I never looked at it that way because, you know, I don't need to impress anybody, or, you know, the size of my title or the size of my office is not what defines me. And I wanted to do something that I was excited to do. And CNN really interested me for a couple of reasons. One, I thought it was big. I thought it was important.
It also was a turnaround.
And it was broken. Yeah. Exactly. So it was big, it was important, it was broken. And I thought that was an opportunity for me. And then the other thing was that it was, you know, it was news and it was live. And there was nothing I loved more than live television and news. And so all of those factors made it such that I was very interested in the job. And then I was fortunate enough that CNN was interested in me.
And you made a bunch of changes. I know you. One of them was very basic. You went back to this is CNN.
First,
yeah, the James Earl Jones thing.
The first
you changed
thing,
graphics. You did.
The first thing I did was brought back the James Earl Jones, this is CNN signature audio, because I thought that signified CNN, and I thought it was just a statement. And I did that on day one, and I was, you know, and that was the first thing I did.
And you brought documentaries and original programming to evenings, but there were still, it was still, CNN was feast or famine.
Yeah.
And when breaking news happens.
Well, what people said about CNN at that time was that, you know, it was pretty much like the spare tire in the trunk. You only brought it out when you needed it. And when there was, you know, big breaking news. And, you know, what we needed to do was we needed to make CNN more relevant all of the time, not just when there was big breaking news. That's part of why we started the original series and the documentaries. And it's also why we started then just going all in on whatever the big story was. And, you know,
sometimes you got ridiculed for that.
We did.
The Malaysian air thing. John Stewart went to town on you on that.
So obviously I had confidence that it was the right thing to do. And I think it has been borne out over time that it was the right thing to do, because what it did was bring audience back to CNN. And that's what we needed to do. And I think what people who criticized it didn't understand was that the media was changing. And the way people were learning about what was going on was from their phone. And they were really getting their headlines and their news from their phone. And what they were coming to television for was to go deep into whatever the big story that was going on and that interested them. They didn't want or need a wheel of news from television anymore. And so that's why we decided to go all in on, for instance, the missing airliner. I thought everybody gets on a plane, and how can a plane just disappear? I can find my iPhone, you know, down the block if I leave it somewhere. How can a big Boeing airliner, you know, just disappear? And so I thought that there was tremendous interest in it, and we were right. And that's why we went deep on it. There were a lot of people who were critical of it. I get it. That's fine. But I still feel we did the right
thing. Let's talk about your relationship with Donald Trump.
Okay.
Because in 2001, you guys both had a need. You needed a big hit, and he needed a way out of what was a lost decade for him, four bankruptcies, and you know, he was not in great shape. And Mark Burnett, a producer, came in and pitched the idea of The Apprentice starring Donald Trump.
Right.
Tell me what appealed to you about that. You must have known Trump from your time in New York.
So I did know Trump from my years in New York, and he had been on the Today Show numerous times, and so we had a relationship. When Mark Burnett pitches this show, which is basically he had done Survivor, he pitches us Survivor in a different jungle, the jungle of Wall Street,
right,
and New York. I immediately and he attaches Donald Trump to it. I immediately got it. In a way that I don't think my competitors at the other entertainment networks in Los Angeles understood. They were all from Los Angeles. I was from New York. Yes, we wanted a big hit, a big reality show, so that appealed to us. But I understood the appeal of Donald Trump in a way that I don't think anybody else did. I knew for a fact that if we bought this show, even if it didn't work, Donald Trump was a publicity magnet. And that he would bring us so much free promotion and marketing in a way that we could never spend enough money to get it marketed, because I knew that he was a tabloid king, and that the New York Post and the New York Daily News would put him on the cover of those tabloids all the time. And I'm not sure that the folks who were in Los Angeles appreciated
and
that.
And you made him the center of the show, ultimately.
Well, he was. That was the
but
pitch.
But the whole boardroom thing was,
you said,
torque that up. Let's put him at the center of the...
Well, that is true.
I'm sure that appealed to him as well.
Well, of course. But, okay, so let me just finish, but you're right about that. So we told Mark Burnett he couldn't leave the NBC studio lot until we got the show, and we bought it, and I turned out to be right that Donald Trump became our best publicist for the show, because he would just call the newspapers all the time.
Right.
He would call them and say, we're the number one show in television. Now, we weren't the number one show in television. We were doing great.
Yeah.
But, by the way, that worked for us at the time, because if he wants to...
That's a habit that continues to this day.
Well, it does. It's something that, you know, obviously we recognize. But, yes, the scene in The Apprentice where the boardroom, we recognized early on that was where the heat was. And so original pitch was that was going to be the last 10 minutes of the show. But, you know, he was charismatic and dynamic in that boardroom. And so we told Mark Burnett, you know, we actually want it to be 25 minutes. And so the show turned into be the whole Donald Trump boardroom.
Was he playing a character?
Of course. He was an actor. He, you know, and he was... You know, he torqued it up and, you know, he was the caricaturized version of Donald Trump. But he was an actor, and he loved it, and he was good at it.
And you tell me about your relationship with him. He was a big star for you. You're the executive. You must have...
I was running NBC Entertainment, and that was our number one show.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was the star of the show. And so, you know, he became... again, I already had a prior relationship mm-hmm. with him, but you know, we became even closer as a result of that.
How often did you talk to him?
I would talk to him several times a week, because all he wanted to do was ever call and talk about
ratings.
The ratings. It's all he ever wanted to talk about, and you know, and he would send me back in that day. There were faxes. Remember fax machines? He would send me faxes of newspaper clippings and things like that. And so, you know, we would talk quite often, and I would come back to New York quite often, and I would see him, and it was a really good
relationship. You wanted to actually broadcast his wedding to Melania, is that right?
No, that is not true. He wanted us to broadcast.
Oh, I see. I knew someone did.
Wedding.
I couldn't figure out who.
He wanted us to broadcast the wedding to Melania.
You were there, I assume.
I did attend. I remember we flew overnight from Los Angeles with a big group of folks who knew mm-hmm. Trump from The Apprentice. We attended the wedding at Mar-a-Lago. As has been well documented by now, it was quite the star-studded event. But yes, he wanted us to broadcast it, and he wanted us to pay him to broadcast it. We said no thank you. But
And you were at Ivanka's wedding as well.
I was at Jared and Ivanka's wedding as a guest of really Donald.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know Jared and Ivanka all that well. I knew them a little bit. But Donald invited me.
Did he talk to you when he was thinking of running for president?
No, he didn't talk to me about any of that. I never really took it very seriously the first few times he flirted with it.
And when he came down the escalator and did his thing, what was your reaction?
So my reaction was, you know, the contents of that speech aside, when he announced, was that, look, I think that I recognized his popular appeal. I think that I understood from The Apprentice and watching him and all of that, that there was a there was a something about Trump and his and his character that was popular, and I thought would work. And I do think that that's one of the reasons that I had CNN pay attention right away to Donald Trump, because I think at a time, if you go back, the first couple months, most national news media organizations did not take it very seriously. CNN did right away, and we turned out to be right.
Well, some would argue that it was a that it's a chicken and egg thing, that part of what CNN did was help.
Yeah, I disagree with that, and I'll tell you why. You know, he announces, comes down the escalator, announces, and 3 weeks later, he's number one in the polls in the Republican Party, and he holds on to that till he becomes a Republican nominee. So he was the favorite among that entire field 3 weeks in. So I don't think that CNN made him number one in 3 weeks, okay? I think that he had that appeal. And we were covering the front runner. We would cover the front runner disproportionately in any race. So I don't buy into that.
You said something earlier in our discussion here that struck me, and it leads to a question about this and television generally. You said the audience wants it. And that is obviously something that's always in your head. Donald Trump understands that if you light yourself on fire, that's good TV.
So look,
you understand that as well, and you needed that was good for CNN, was it not?
Well, look, I'm not going to apologize. I think what a lot of people want is for, you know, people to say that you should apologize for giving the audience what they're interested in. This goes back to the plane, and we took a lot of heat for the poop cruise at one time. Listen, I think what we have always done, whether it was at the Today Show or CNN, is we've never been above what the audience is interested in. And I think this idea that, you know, you should only feed the audience spinach and you should tell them what's important, I reject that.
Well, there is this tension between the television news or news generally as a trust and as a business. And how do you balance those things?
But we're both. I mean, listen, I think that you cannot pretend you know, that we're not a business, right? And by the way, doing journalism costs money, and it costs a lot of money. And so you're running a business, and I don't think anyone should apologize for that. At the same time, we're running a journalistic organization, and we should do what's important, and we should also do what's interesting. And I don't apologize for those two things. And I think they can coexist. And I think, if anything, over the last 5-6 years, that's what we've brought to CNN. And I think it's a mix of what's important and what's popular.
Do you think, looking back, that you would you have made the same decisions relative to the coverage of Trump, giving him, you know, covering his events as extensively as you did?
Yeah. So I think that we made a mistake in airing as many of his rallies live and unedited as we did. I've said that before, and I've acknowledged it. And I said we made a mistake. Now, what's interesting to me is that our competitors did the same thing, and they've never acknowledged that they made a mistake. That's okay. I don't need them to do that. I only control what we do. Yes, we made a mistake. I do not believe that's why he's president of the United States. A lot of people want to assign that blame to us and to me. If only we had that much power, especially on the Republican side. I do not believe that's why he's president of the United States, but I do think we made a mistake.
He has singled CNN out. I mean, that's no secret. And I wonder sometimes, you know, MSNBC, and you were there when MSNBC became as MSNBC, and you identified then that there needed to be a liberal sort of counterpart to Fox, and that was a niche market. It's still that.
Yeah.
And yet, he never talks about MSNBC. He always talks about CNN. Is that personal to you? How much of it involves you, and how much of it involves him wanting to decommission CNN as a place where sort of swing voters might go that is credible?
Yeah. So I think it's both. And I'm not ducking the question. Yeah. I really do genuinely think it's both reasons. Look, he obviously he attacks CNN. He attacks CNN for a couple reasons. One, we're relevant, right? If we weren't relevant, if we didn't matter, he'd just ignore us. He understands that CNN matters. He understands that CNN matters in the United States and around the world. And he understands that CNN has a disproportionate amount of swing and independent voters that, frankly, MSNBC doesn't have and that he would like. So for all of those reasons, CNN is important. I also think that CNN, to him, is the institutions that he attacks the most, the New York Times in the media. The New York Times, Saturday Night Live, and CNN are, frankly, the media institutions that he grew up with in New York that he cared about and whose respect he coveted. So I think that's a part of it. And then I think the third piece of it has to do with me. And the fact is, we've had this long, 20-plus year relationship that for a long time was quite strong. And Donald Trump did not understand in the end that just because we were friends didn't mean he wasn't going to be subjected to the proper scrutiny. He didn't understand. He thought CNN should give him a pass because we were friends. He thought CNN should be like Fox News and just, give him glowing coverage all the time. Listen, it's my opinion that if he should get the coverage that's appropriate and that he deserves, but he's not going to get anything just because we're friends. And so I think that he does hold that against me and CNN, and I think it's the combination of all of those reasons. CNN matters, it's relevant, it's an institution he grew up with, and he doesn't understand why I'm not fully loyal, are all of the reasons why he disproportionately attacks CNN.
So there is an element of disapprobation particularly among anchors who have shows and so on that is expressed. How much do you encourage that, discourage that, and are there limits to that? That are you worried about a line being crossed?
Yeah. So I think that our job at CNN is to tell the truth and to stand on the side of pro-truth. I think the problem is, in this day and age, I do understand that sometimes when you're pro-truth, it comes off as anti-Trump. In no way should we set out ever to be anti-Trump. We should always set out to be pro-truth. And all I encourage our shows and our anchors to be is to hold those in power accountable and to tell the truth. If that comes off as anti-Trump, then that's just the byproduct of being pro-truth.
He has made CNN one of his targets, and you became a target when that bomber sent out his bombs. You put out a pretty strong statement, appropriately, I think, about that. Did you call him?
No. Listen, we've endured for years now his comments about the media and CNN in particular and the attacks on CNN. And as a result, the safety of our people for several years now has been a real issue. And then all of a sudden we found ourselves in the position where some lunatic was sending bombs to the people who work for us. And that and at the same time, on that same day, the press secretary of the White House put out a statement in which she condemned all of those attacks on everybody but CNN. And at some point, frankly, I thought enough was enough. And
but because you have a personal relationship with him, I wondered whether you felt like picking up the call, the phone, and saying, what the hell are you doing?
Well, if I felt that would change the way he has behaved, I would do it in a second, obviously. I have no issue with picking up the phone, but I think he has proven because we've said it time and again that these words are dangerous, and are going to result in something like somebody sending bombs, and he knows that, and his people know that, and yet they've continued to do it. And frankly, I think it is one of the most destructive things that he has done. And listen, it's okay. I can take all the criticism you want. I've taken criticism my whole career. It's okay. But you know, when you're inciting your followers to do things because he's saying that CNN sucks and isn't fair to him.
Well, enemies of the people is a strong phrase.
And when you're calling the media and CNN enemies of the people, you know, you're crossing a line. And that's why I put out the statement I did, because enough is enough.
Are you worried that it's going to get more frantic as the 2020 approaches?
Look, I think that it's hard to believe that it could get more frantic, but it might.
I can't let you go without asking you two things. Where is television and cable television in particular going to be in 5 years from now? I've got kids who are cord cutters. There's a voracious appetite for content, but not necessarily for cable. And then I need to ask you where you think you're going to be in 5 years.
So with regard to cable and television, I mean, listen, first of all, nobody knows for sure. So anybody who tells you definitively where this industry is going, run away from. But having said that, look, the trends are clear and obvious, and that traditional, I think television will still exist and television will still be around, but I think it will, live events like news and sports will be the things that will endure the longest and be around. And it's clear that when it comes to entertainment, people want to consume it when they want to consume it, where they want to consume it, how they want to consume it. And I think that trend will only continue. And with regard to where I'll be in 5 years,
you had a chance to leave to potentially take over ESPN, which you're a big sports guy.
Yeah.
That was the timing wasn't right for you. But
well, to be clear, I was never offered the
No, I understand.
Look, I don't know for sure where I'll be, but here's the two things that I do know is if the Miami Dolphins call, that's where I'll be. Or number
You've said
two.
This twice now, and I know
I'm
they're
trying to send
I know
a
they're big listeners of my podcast.
Exactly.
So,
and number two,
this could be shorten your
and
career
number two,
here.
Look, I still harbor somewhere in my gut that I'm still very interested in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I would.
You turned down an opportunity to work for Al Gore in 2000. You've talked in the past about potentially running for office.
So I'm still interested in that. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I would consider.
Interesting. Well, give me a call if you're thinking about it.
You know somebody who can
I
help?
Do. I can.
Okay.
I do.
You can put me in touch with the right
I
people.
I can, yeah. Jeff Zucker, so good to sit down with you. Appreciate you. For you to sit in one place for an hour is an extraordinary accomplishment, and I'm so grateful that you did it.
I would only do it for you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit axefilespodcast.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.